The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today's episode is all about us. About how we, as average non-expert people, can determine what is and is not science. Most of us read news stories that tell us many wonderful and or terrible things. And as lay people, we often don't have the background to judge what the real breakthroughs or dangers are. So how can we go about separating legitimate scientific controversies from manufactured ones? Here to help us do that are Eric Davis and Steve Toms of SkepticNorth.com. But first, to Speaking Up. I'm here with Nick and Tom Croucher, the creators of both the Skeptic Bros website and the Placebo Band. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Hi, Desiree.
So what are the Placebo Bands?
Basically, it's a lampooning of the balance bands that are very, very popular at the moment. I was reading a magazine, and then this band was in there. Now, I'd listened to the Skeptic Zone and had heard Travis Roy on there talking about the bands and how obvious it was that they didn't work. And so I thought, these guys are trying to help people out. I'll get on Facebook and I'll send them a message and say, you know, what are you doing advertising these bands? They're a bit of a joke. And I got a pat answer back, which wasn't really what I was looking for. And Flip Richard Saunders a message. We got Travis Roy in there and we had a bit of a spat with these guys on Facebook. And it sort of snowballed from there.
I got roped in by Tom because I also have a Facebook account and could rant and rave. So that's how we first got interested in these bands.
Tell me about the power bands themselves. What are their claims?
Their claims basically are that they have a band which is inert and a hologram in the band which is programmed with frequencies. And these frequencies then attune your body to the correct frequency. Some of the different bands make slightly different claims at this point, but they tend to say that by aligning these frequencies in your body, the neurons from the brain can control your body a bit better and you can be stronger and more flexible and have better balance. Some sites claim that there's some scientific basis behind it. Other sites claim it's based on Eastern medicine. But there seems to be no basis for it.
So how do your placebo bands work then?
Exactly the same way. there's nothing to them. I mean, these bands aren't powered in any way. There's no way they can emit any type of frequency. It's not like you've got a player on your arm to extract the information from the holograms or anything. We thought we'd go with some truth in advertising and what we thought the bands actually are doing, which is you go along to a demonstration, somebody does some neat tricks, and if they do them fast enough and fluid enough, you might come away thinking that this band that they've shown you is what's having the effect when they're doing these balance tricks on your body. And like any good magician, if they're doing them right, they are pretty convincing, and your brain sort of fills in the gaps with the way you want it to. And we thought, well, if that's the real effect, we'll just advertise it as what it is, which is placebo coupled with a confirmation bias. You're wearing one of these things, you might go, oh, well, I feel a bit sporty, I'll go for a run this morning. You might not have been for 6 months, but you've gone for a run, you feel good at the end of it, wow, this band works. That's how placebo band works. We thought we'd take it to the nth degree of funny and make it so, you know, whatever you believe in the placebo band will do.
But there is a certain element of, I believe it's Richard Saunders that calls it applied kinesiology.
Yeah, and the applied kinesiologists have chimed in and said, oh, that's not strictly applied kinesiology. We do it this way and that way, and we've been studying it for years, and those simple balance tricks aren't really it. But it's all basically the same stuff. Like the people doing these balance tests, if you've ever seen them, and there's plenty online, you can see that they're shifting their weight to push people off balance or hold them in place. And whether they know they're doing it or not, I don't think really matters. You've got a preconceived idea of what's going to happen, and the effects and the balance tricks are really subtle to do. You don't have to force them off balance.
You have a couple of tricks on your website that you ask people to do. Can you tell us about those?
The original idea was it'd be sort of a back of a comic book. Get this and fool your friends, sort of like you were selling a cheap magic trick. From the videos that I'd seen on YouTube and stuff, and from their own diagrams and things, we tried a few of the balance tricks here, and they're pretty easy to do. You don't have to shift your weight much to get the effect they're looking for. So probably the most common one is where you have your subject stand with their feet together, hands by their sides, and cup one hand away from their body. And then you put your fist into their hand and lean down. Now, it's almost imperceivable the amount you have to shift your weight to pull them off balance. If they're standing with their feet together, you know, the center of gravity is right in the middle, and they're basically a stick standing up. And then to support them, all you need to do is lean just a little bit into their body, and you create sort of a tripod thing with your feet. So you don't have to move much to get them off center or to support them. And the difference being is you just do one with the band on and one with the band off. And it's so subtle that if you're thinking that they will stand up, they will. It's almost sort of idiomotor how subtle it is. So I did it with a friend of mine at a party. They were asking me what it was. I said, here, hold this magic beer in one hand, and did it. And my dad was there, and he said, oh, I know how you do that. You put the beer in his other hand, and that sort of balances him. I'm like, no, I didn't even do that. I just leaned a little away or towards his body. You don't have to do much to have these effects.
So now, how did you guys figure this out? The theme of this episode is how regular non-scientist people can develop an understanding of what the scientific consensus is around particular topics. So are either of you professional scientists?
No, I didn't even really go to the end of high school. Dropped out, started a band, grew my hair long. So no, I'm not a scientist. I am, however, a podcast junkie. By the time we got to Power Balance, Richard Saunders had already sort of busted them on Australian TV. There's a current affairs show over here that just went with it sort of fairly credulously and did pretty much an infomercial for Power Balance. And Richard rang up and called Shenanigans, and they flew him to their studios, and they did 5 tests. And that pretty much clearly demonstrated that the tricks were fairly easy to replicate. And from there, you don't have to do a lot of research to realize that there's not a lot of science behind what they're saying. Yeah, so I got my information from a popular media source.
Nick, how about you? Do you have any background in anything related to this field?
Not directly related. Definitely not in any sort of biology or anything like that. Although I do have some training with electronics. So as soon as they started saying, oh, it has some sort of frequency, because we saw the videos, and basically what they were saying is, oh, it operates at a certain frequency. And I've gone, well, a frequency of what? So I took their magic number that they said, I think it was 7.8 something hertz, and I whacked that into Google, and I found what's called the Schumann resonance frequency, which was a resonance chamber set up between the ionosphere and the Earth that apparently causes this detectable electromagnetic resonance. So if you have something in that chamber, which is, I guess, our biosphere, then you can measure this, and it can be detected on lightning, which goes between the two points, the ionosphere and Earth. And I read all about this, and then I read that some of these frequencies were being misappropriated by people that are doing alternative medicine and things like that, and obviously with the power band as well, saying that, oh, this is nature's frequency and we all must attune to this. But they never mention what it's a frequency of or how it connects in any way to anything else. So being unable to find that sort of information, you just then look to see if other people are mentioning it or trying to measure it or any of this sort of stuff, and you just get nowhere. And there seems to be no proof, no evidence for it. So based on that, we've gone, well, this probably doesn't work.
And we have, as you've mentioned, we've spoken about this in Skeptic Circles. Richard Saunders of the Skeptic Zone podcast, and Travis Roy, and Barbara Drescher at ICBS Everywhere. She, at the amazing meeting this year in Las Vegas, spoke about how her young son disproved the claims of one of the many, many brands of these bracelets in a science experiment.
So many of those.
So are you actually aiming the placebo bands at a broader public then?
When I saw Robert De Niro wearing one, I figured that it had gone beyond surfers and sportsmen and that type of thing and was now a fashion item. The meaning of them and the pseudoscience is almost secondary now. They're basically being sold as a fashion item, so
right,
we could do what we wanted.
But how much do these cost?
The bands in the store can vary from $40 and $60. We sell ours for $2. And ours is basically cost price for us in a very, very low volume. Whereas these guys, they must be able to make them for probably less than 50 cents each.
And you guarantee yours to do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
No, we don't guarantee ours at all.
Did I say yes? Did you say no?
That was brilliant.
Yes. Dude, what's the guarantee on the website say? Is absolutely...
It guarantees not to do anything. I'm happy with that.
So yes and no is the answer.
So do you think that this is something that the public will pick up on, the placebo bracelets?
What we're finding is we've put the cash up and did the tooling and got it done. And we're finding a lot of people who sort of had a similar idea going, well, your initial cost prices are a bit prohibitive if you only want 50. There's a guy in New Zealand who got a skateboard brand and he wanted to do a skateboard deck with a graphic that was basically lampooning these balance bands. And he was going to get his own bands made up with a BS band on it. But he found that the initial cost to actually get the thing molded was prohibitive and he only wanted 50. Basically, if you're ordering less than 1,000, it's going to cost you through the nose. So he got in contact with us and ordered 50 bands straight out because it was close enough to his idea. Richard Saunders has been buying them in lots of 10 and 20, and he goes and gives them away, basically. He does balance tests with people and that type of thing. We're getting a lot of people who are buying them in lots of 10 and 15 and using them for education or their own purposes or whatever.
And they can use the tricks that you put out on the website to show their friends how the placebo bands do work exactly like the power balance bracelets or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, for sure. And you don't have to use the placebo band, although it looks pretty flash.
It's a lovely design.
You know, you could view this as a fairly innocuous product, though. There are all sorts of really dangerous alternative health claims out there. So why take this on?
Because it was easy.
Yeah. This is our first project. We started the blog after a holiday we were both on, and we were sort of struggling. Well, we're not struggling, but debating, do we do a podcast? There's a million of those, and they're really good. Do we do videos? Well, we could do that, but we live on opposite sides of the country. We just keep ticking along with the blog, and we said, yeah, it'll have a skeptical bent because we're both into that, but if we write something about zombies, or it won't matter, we can do what we like, it's a blog. And then this thing came up, and it was a conversation we had. I said, man, why don't they just call it a placebo band? It is what it is. It's a fashion item now, it's taken off. And a day later, Nick's come back and said, well, we could get these made for this much. And it snowballed from there.
And since then, they've been selling extremely well, far beyond what we expected. As Tom said about Richard Saunders giving us lots of plugs, I think we've mentioned his name less times in this interview than he mentioned our names on the last podcast.
Richard Saunders. Oh, and Travis Roy. Look, the reason Richard knew who we were is because I just got a hold of Travis on Facebook and said, keep it hush-hush, but what do you think of this idea? And he was like, yes. He was so enthusiastic. And he said, you need to talk to Oz Skeptics because they were going to do something like that. So I rang Oz Skeptics and said, look, we're getting these made. Can we help you guys? And from there, that went as well. Yeah, a lot of it was good timing. Had we thought of this idea now, somebody else might have already done it.
So where can people find them?
On the website, hopefully for a little bit more time till this batch runs out. After this batch, we're not sure if we're going to continue or not. But if there's some left there, definitely go to skepticbros.com and check out our store.
Perfect. Thanks for being here, guys.
No worries. Thank you, Desiree.
Since I spoke to Nick and Tom, there's been a new development in the magic bracelet saga. The Australian Therapeutic Goods Administration has ruled against Power Balance, the most well-known of the magic bracelet companies. The decision says in part, in reaching this conclusion, the panel noted that the claims made in the advertisements were extraordinary to such a degree that no reasonable retailer could publish them on the basis of assurances from the product sponsor without requesting evidence that such claims could be lawfully made about the product. The TGA are asking for the withdrawal of representations, withdrawal of advertisement, and the publication of a retraction. You can find out more about the decision at the website of the Victorian branch of the Australian Skeptics at vicskeptics.wordpress.com. We'll also have a link to the post in this episode's show notes. And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes, and while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm on the line with Steve Toms, professional music teacher, amateur astronomer, and award-winning astrophotographer in Kitchener, Ontario. We're also joined by Eric Davis, a technology professional based in Toronto, who holds an MBA in business strategy and a BA in English. They're both contributors to SkepticNorth.com, the pan-Canadian skeptical blog collective. Welcome, guys.
Hi, Des.
So we've had members of Skeptic North on the show before. Steve, you've been on a few times now?
I think I have. I think this is number four for me now.
I believe that's correct. Well, most of the people that write for Skeptic North fall into the lay people category. And even when they have a background in science, they often write about topics that aren't in their field, correct?
Yeah, definitely. Most of our writers are very much lay person, as you say. I mean, I have a music background and a politics background, but I'm one of those late in life science enthusiasts, like I'm sure many of our writers are.
So basically, all the writers are regular people writing about the state of consensus science, then?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Well, let's define consensus science. Eric, you want to take that?
Consensus science is basically the state of affairs when the vast majority of scientists working in a field agree on something. It doesn't necessarily apply unanimity, but it means that there is a scientific model that has held up against repeated scrutiny, and that the majority of scientists, and I would say it's more than a simple majority, it's the vast bulk of scientists agree on.
So would you agree with that, Steve?
I would, too. Yeah, I would.
Good. So is that consensus in one field, then, or would it be consensus across overlapping fields? Like with germ theory, let's say. Medical doctors, parasitologists, and microbiologists all agree that the little buggers are the problem.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the rub with a particular scientific theory, is that you get independent confirmation from multiple sources. When it comes to plate tectonics, we have multiple sources of evidence from geography and geology and evolution and climate and all sorts of sources. And when you have a vast number of scientists all agreeing from multiple disciplines into one convergent point, I think then you could say consensus.
So what about if those within a field agree, but the people in overlapping fields don't? Would that still be considered consensus science?
I think it depends on what you're talking about and what the impact on the other fields is.
Could you give me an example?
I'm not sure I can. Steve, do you have anything off the top of your head?
Well, there's a lot of scientific issues that have a much bigger impact than just science. I'm thinking of things like evolution and vaccination and stem cell research. These are huge, huge, huge scientific fields that involve multiple people from lots and lots of different areas. Thinking of vaccination, you have microbiologists and embryologists and anatomists and all sorts of various scientific fields that I can't even think about naming because I'm a music teacher. There's definitely a social impact as well that often doesn't get a lot of track in discussions, especially when communicating to the public, these sorts of things.
Well, let's say that, again, the people in the field agree, but those in the overlapping fields didn't. Would that be a warning signal then?
Could be. I mean, a good example, this doesn't happen as often anymore because there is an awful lot more cross-disciplinary work that goes on among different fields or interrelated fields than there used to be. But if you go back, actually not too long ago, in psychology, for the first half of the century or so, behavioralists held sway within the psychological community. And the shift from behaviorism to the cognitive psychology that is generally viewed as the correct approach to psychology today, or the one that has the most theoretical underpinnings and research behind it. The challenge actually came from a linguist, Noam Chomsky, who said, you know, the behaviorist view, which was that pretty much all of our everything is learned. We are a blank slate, and we come into this world, and cultural effects are predominant. You know, it was Chomsky who came and said, well, hold on, if you look at my field, it's pretty apparent that we have a natural grammar, that there is something called a mind design that makes languages consistent in their function across different cultures. And that was the reason that people started to second-guess behavioralism and look at mind design as a reason or a logic behind psychology.
So is that fairly typical? How does something go from being consensus science to not?
There's a couple of ways. I mean, if you look at the early theorists on the scientific method, they basically viewed it, folks like Karl Popper viewed science as very much a dynamic process. There was consensus, and, you know, new data would come in, the consensus would change. You know, his focus was very much on falsifiability and the belief that a single experiment, replicated and reviewed, could disprove a scientific theory, and lo and behold, the whole world would change. I think in practice, as later philosophers have pointed out, folks like Thomas Kuhn, you know, there actually is more of a tipping point effect where, you know, new data emerges that doesn't fit the existing working model. And it's, you know, one of two things happens. It's either incorporated, meaning, you know, people make a minor adjustment to the working model and incorporate it, or it's viewed as an outlier. And if it's an outlier, maybe replicated or it may not. If it's not, then the working model holds. If it is replicated, then there will probably be more studies that come to try to find more outliers and put more holes in the working model. And eventually, someone will propose a new working model that incorporates the outliers and as well as the existing body of data before the outliers. And then, you know, what Kuhn called a paradigm shift happens, and the consensus starts to change.
And I think, too, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Eric, but I think it was also Kuhn that pointed out that sometimes the paradigm shifts happen mainly, or at least sometimes, I should say, when the older generation simply dies out. You'll have a generation of scientists unable or unwilling to accept the new paradigm, something like the Big Bang Theory. It didn't get a lot of traction until the older generation of the steady-state theorists were effectively died out. It sounds kind of like a cold and caustic way of putting it, but I think it did come down to that in a good number of the cases anyway.
Yeah, and I think what Kuhn recognized that earlier theorists didn't is that scientists are not immune to the basic human desire for certainty, right? And a lot of the challenge with consensus generally and in getting the public to look at you know, the consensus opinion is that humans have a very strong desire for certainty. And we see this over and over again in all of the various cognitive biases that psychologists and cognitive scientists have pointed out, confirmation bias and various group effects. And so, you know, we're constantly driven to try to calm the cognitive dissonance, the questions that go on our mind by looking for certainty. Scientists aren't immune to that, and I think that's what folks like Kuhn realized that Popper didn't, is that, you know, they're humans too. And, you know, to Steve's point, sometimes it does take a generation to die out or a really big challenge from another field, as in the case of behavioralism versus cognitive psychology.
So would we be talking about the difference between sort of consensus science and popular opinion then?
Yeah, I think there's a very, very big difference. And there are several reasons I think that the public has such a hard time with science. And I think we see this over and over again. But, you know, to my mind, there are kind of three big issues. You know, the first is that we really, as you know, lay people, don't generally speak the language of science, which is math. And in fact, for most of the issues that affect our day-to-day, it's really statistics. Certainly calculus is big in physics, but for most of the things that, you know, affect how we interact with the world, statistics is the language of science, and we are functionally innumerate from a scientific perspective. So few people understand the basics of statistics, much less the higher workings of it. Yet, hardly a scientific exploration happens without a computer-aided stats package these days. You know, I think the second is that we also tend to think we're smarter than we are, and that our native sort of cognitive processes, our common sense is useful scientifically, and we're not that smart, and it's not useful. You know, as I mentioned, there's several cognitive biases that cloud our judgment. Our emotions control us more than we think we do. We try to calm the cognitive dissonance by striving to be certain, which is not the same thing as being right. We're subject to confirmation bias and group dynamics, et cetera. And, you know, scientists, you know, are, as I pointed out, subject to the same problems, but we've designed things like, you know, proper study design to work around those flaws. And hopefully scientists are a little more practiced in their metacognitive skills. They're second-guessing their own cognitive processes. And the third, I think, is that we have a basic human belief that knowledge is something that should be absolute and immutable. And that we, you know, have a hard time accepting a scientific definition of knowledge, which is probabilistic. It's, you know, based on, we think this is the case, we've tried it, we're confident within this confidence interval this many times out of 20. You know, that may change if we get some new information.
I think the idea of our common sense being really lousy at us, that's going to be a theme, I think, that most skeptics encounter. We are really lousy judges for the natural world, because to our natural world, the world is flat. And that is a rational thing to come across, too, because our eyes see a flat world. That makes sense. But rational and logic don't mean the same thing. And once you actually perform a scientific experiment to see if the world is flat, you end up coming wanting. And the common sense kind of underscores what Eric was talking about with the need for certainty. I think with a lot of people, with that craving for certainty, I mean, this is the reason why we read newspapers that are politically charged that happen to align with our own politics, or we seek out an author that writes the way we like to write or read. We are familiar with what we're familiar with. It sounds kind of circular, but we need these things to make sense. And going back to the, perfect solids. I mean, there was this ancient need for nature to be perfect and predictable and harmonious. But a few thousand years of science after that kind of says that, well, no, we can't just dive into this sense of wishful thinking.
Well, let's go back to the flat Earth, because I actually like that example. So consensus science said that the Earth was flat until direct evidence to the contrary was provided, correct?
I believe so.
Anyone? Wasn't actually there.
Right. Good. Well, I'm wondering, how much evidence would you need? Like, how much direct evidence does something need before it's considered to be consensus science? I want numbers here, people. Nobody can give me those, can you?
I'm not sure I have numbers, but again, I think it comes down to, you know, there is a working model. There has been a significant amount of, there's a number of attempts to disprove it. Those have all failed, and people have been trying for a while, and the bulk of people who do it for a living agree. I don't know that there's a number of studies, and I think it's going to vary from field to field, but the point of consensus, right, which is not the only type of science out there. There's lots of issues where there's no consensus, where there's just groundwork science being done, and there's no consensus yet in that field on certain issues. But if we're talking about what is a consensus, then you really do need, I don't know, maybe it's 85-90% of scientists who work in the field saying, yeah, this is the case. And the other thing to look at is the major bodies that represent those scientists. What is their opinion on the subject? In every country, there are bodies of scientists. There are working groups that advise various government and parliamentary committees. What are they saying on the issue? If they're coming out with very clear statements, I think that you can view that as consensus.
There's not just numbers of organizations that represent the scientists involved, but a lot of people, I think, get confused by organizations that represent people affected by a particular sense of science. Like when you come to climate change, you'll see industry voicing one thing, or tobacco companies. They will have their particular stance saying cigarettes don't cause cancer. And you'll have competing PR firms launching massive, massive campaigns saying widely conflicting things. And in the age of the internet, you have people that are informing themselves, which is really that double-edged sword. I mean, the democratization of knowledge is also the democratization of ignorance. I hate to sound so crass in that case, but the term self-educated on the internet, well, I don't like that term insofar as you're informing yourself, you're not educating yourself, and there is a difference.
I'm not actually sure I'd agree with that, Steve. I think the point is, what the sources are, right? I do research on the internet all the time, but like anyone who no different than going to a library. You have to know where the credible sources are,
yeah,
and who you trust. In a library, it's easier because you have a curator. Although, you know, often university libraries are quite large and contain all sorts of stuff that may not be, you know, consistent with the consensus, including old work that is no longer relevant. And, you know, as well as, you know, full periodicals and what have you that represent a view that is not the consensus. So I think, like anything, you have to develop a sense of what is a trustworthy and credible source when you're educating yourself, whether it's on the internet or anywhere else.
I was thinking more of like a formalized educational structure when, if you don't have the necessary wherewithal to identify what is a credible source, something like a university or college system is well apt to provide the student with such a framework. That was sort of my point on that one.
Yeah, I think that's another show topic all in and of itself. Yeah.
I was going to say.
I'd love to listen in on that one.
Audience, you're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Steve Toms and Eric Davis about consensus science. Email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So let's try to put this into practice a bit. We'll look at an example that you guys have been working on recently, the wireless issue in Ontario. Can one of you tell me how that became an issue there?
Well, the claim was that back in February, there was a bunch of kids, I think 12 to 15 kids in a small rural area that were reporting headaches, nausea, difficulty concentrating, difficulty sleeping, behavioral problems, this massive list of nonspecific symptoms that I think any kid, any person gets from time to time. But one person said that, okay, well, these kids are reporting these symptoms, what has been different? Well, the school installed these Wi-Fi emitters. Must be the Wi-Fi. And then for the next several months, they launched a campaign to quote-unquote study the effects of Wi-Fi, even though we've not seen any studies from this particular committee. And they've just concluded, seemingly out of the blue, that the Wi-Fi emitters was causing this massive list of non-specific symptoms, which got bigger and bigger as more and more national media paid attention to them. And since then, this has gone beyond this one small town, and it's gone to a few cities in Ontario, and I believe it's also led over into Alberta just recently.
Yes, it has.
I haven't followed too much of the Alberta case, but it can't be too different because the science is very clear, and it's like Eric said, with the number of organizations representing scientists that are experts in this field, they've studied this for years and years and years, and contrary to popular belief, there are long-term studies about the effects of these wireless signals. I think Eric can talk more about the specific organizations and what they found.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, if you check out Skeptic North, there's a recent article I did that has about 20 organizations for pretty much every Western government, several very highly credible NGOs, including Cancer Society, et cetera, that are all unanimous in the fact that the research does not justify. But I just want to read you what I think is really the money quote from the World Health Organization. It says, you know, in the area of biological effects and medical application of non-ionizing radiation, which includes cell phones, Wi-Fi, power fields, approximately 25,000 articles have been published over the past 30 years. Despite the feeling of some people that more research needs to be done, scientific knowledge in this area is now more extensive than for most chemicals. Based on a recent in-depth review of the scientific literature, the World Health Organization concluded that the current evidence does not confirm the existence of any health consequences from exposure to low-level electromagnetic fields. You cannot get more clear than that.
Well, what made you think initially that this movement, I suppose I'll call it, wasn't exactly evidence-based?
I think from my side, it's that I've heard the EMF fears before, electromagnetic frequency radiation fears before. The same pattern, this template has shown up with power fields, has shown up with cell phones. Wi-Fi is really just the latest, I think, in a string of fears that invisible rays will kill us. So when you see the template enough times, you learn to recognize it, and the skeptical bells go off.
And we have a caller on the line.
You said something about taking a group, say a certain group, and understanding their position. But when you look back towards Galileo, you take the Vatican, and they were the consensus at the time, saying that was the science that everything went around the Earth. How is it not? Do you not question some groups at some point?
I think we absolutely must. That's part of the scientific process. But what ends up happening, in order to get that kind of paradigm shift that Kuhn talks about that I referenced earlier, you know, for every time there's a paradigm shift, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of dead ends, sometimes thousands of dead ends. There are researchers who attempt to find a path and don't find it. But there are also a lot of researchers who end up in a somewhat, quixotic quest to find something that's just not there. And I think what we've seen with the Wi-Fi thing, and you know, you end up, if you follow the Canadian media, there's one scientist out of Trent, professor out of Trent named Magda Habas. You know, this is someone who spent basically 30 years of her career trying to prove that there is a danger to electromagnetic radiation. And she has some studies that that show that there is some effect. These have, without question, failed to be replicated and failed to be embraced by the broader scientific community. Not because they're hostile to it, but because, you know, A, it's an outlier, and B, you know, there have been, you know, methodological issues and failure to replicate this with an awful lot of her research. In fact, we just had a guest post by Lauren Trottier, who's an advisor to the CFI's Committee for Advancement of Scientific Skepticism, with a piece that, you know, without actually even an awful lot of work, found some fairly large flaws in her latest research that shows these heart rate effects when people are near radiation. And, you know, not only just methodological flaws, but even purely logical flaws that fly in the face of everything we know about how heart rates work. You know, the fact that they jump down immediately after the radiation has gone off. You can certainly see heart rates rise quickly. That's what adrenaline does. But they don't just fall off immediately. And that's what her research found. So, you know, we see these researchers who seem to be letting their beliefs about what should be there cloud their judgment about what they're actually seeing, or cloud the methodology, or cloud the research design. So we get these outliers, but so far, in at least 30 years of trying, there hasn't been a paradigm shift on it. In fact, there has been continued reinforcement in the consensus.
And I just want to add, too, in the case of Galileo, I'm probably oversimplifying things here, but he wasn't necessarily going up against scientific consensus. He was going up against convention. And I say that because he was one of the first to actually do direct experimentation and direct measurement. So he wasn't really going against scientific consensus, because it didn't really exist so well at the time anyway.
So how did you research this in the first place? Step by step is what we want. This is a how-to guide for the listeners.
Well, what I did is I just kind of looked at the actual claims that were being made by the various committees that were pushing this agenda, and I wanted to see if there actually was an effect, if the number of kids that were coming home and reporting these symptoms, if that was a statistically significant thing. And I don't have the wherewithal as far as statistics understanding to process that kind of information. But as near as I could tell, it was less than 1% of all kids in that area were reporting these non-specific symptoms. So that didn't impress me very much. And then I looked at the level of Wi-Fi in that particular town, and I compared it to other areas, such as Toronto and Ottawa and London, Ontario, and Hamilton. And I was wondering, well, how come these kids are reporting it in this town, but not in Wi-Fi saturated areas? And to say nothing of Toronto, what about Tokyo or London or Los Angeles? And from there, I just kind of looked at the basic arguments, and they were thin, as they kind of usually are when you deal with somebody who is making these fringe, or, as Eric says, these quixotic claims. They kind of seem to have an axe to grind, and they would say, we've done these studies, and you would never see one lick of them. Or they would put the same three names over and over again, like Magda Habas, like Eric mentioned, was trumpeted over and over again as the big expert in this field. And when you compare her studies, as Eric said, with the other mountain, the 25,000 other papers that showed safety versus Magda Habas's one, it was kind of a no-brainer at that point.
That point can't be overstated. You know, one of the things that we struggle with as people who, you know, have a passion about seeing, some level of science get out into the public is what we call false balance of the media reporting. You know, the challenge that we have, and this is a really good example, is that, you know, there may be a vast majority, thousands and thousands and thousands of scientists who are basically aligned on the basic science around EMF radiation and Wi-Fi and cell phones, et cetera. And there may be a few or several scientists who are against it. Now, those scientists may be right, although, as I said, in 30 years plus of trying, they haven't been able to change the consensus, so that tells you something in and of itself. But in the media, what you get is one for and one against. So one out of 10,000 that think this is nonsense, and one out of 3 or 5 or 10 that think this is what's going on. And that is a false balance. It doesn't represent the issue, but it seems like balance. You have one from each side.
So yeah, is that the case with EMF? What is the ratio of those who think it's safe to those who think it's not safe?
Well, again, every major research organization, representation of you know, the scientists working in this field, every major government is aligned on one side, and you have a handful of researchers, most of whom have gone through the same arguments with cell phone before in power. Magda Havas did her early work in power fields and have been making the same arguments for quite a while and not swaying the consensus. You know, I have to believe because the science isn't there. I'm not a scientist. I'm not qualified to judge the merits of her paper or the consensus paper. And it may be that there's a smoking gun that's found and everybody on one side missed something. But it's up to the scientists who have uncovered that flaw to change the consensus. And until they do, it's unreasonable for a layperson like myself to question the consensus. It just is. And I think this comes down to what it means to know something in a science-based world. Anyone who's ever taken an epistemology course will be familiar with the study of knowledge and the definitions of knowledge. But you don't actually have to take one to get the basis of it. Historically, philosophers have believed that knowledge is something that is absolute and out there and generally knowable, and that striving for perfect knowledge, there's some perfect knowledge out there, is the goal of human scientific exploration. Since around the 17th century or so, since the scientific revolution, there has been a very different view of, you know, what it means to know something, and that knowledge is really based in probability and statistics. There's a reason that it took 2,000 years or so of human history between Plato and Aristotle and the early work by Francis Bacon in rediscovering induction in the scientific revolution, because we didn't have a language to talk about what we call inductive reasoning and inductive method. We didn't have a language to quantify it. So the bulk of human history basically tried to learn new things from what we already know. It's called deductive reasoning, right? We through careful thought and careful logic, we take a bunch of known premises and discover new information. The scientific revolution said there's another way, and in fact a better way, to understand the world, which is we observe it and we measure it and we try to figure out what's going on based on that. You know, it's called inductive reasoning. It's from the specific to the general, instead of from the general to the specific. So we gather data about the world, and then we come up with a theory about how the world is working. We validate that theory and we try to quantify it. But what that comes with, because we're only ever looking at a sample of the data, is a confidence interval. It's a statistical assessment of how likely it is the information that we have is correct. And getting comfortable with that definition of knowledge, a knowledge that says, we don't know this for certain. There's no such thing as knowing something for certain. What there is having tried to disprove this is true, failed, and we're sure within these bands, these statistical bands, plus or minus 3% 19 times out of 20 is something you see on polls all the time. That's a confidence interval. It says how confident we are that this piece of information is correct. All scientific knowledge comes with that, but that's hard for most people to take. We want certainty, as we said earlier, and you need to get comfortable with that sort of definition of scientific knowledge, and that it is far more reasonable to play the odds and go with what the consensus says, because that's the likely outcome, than to bet on the long shot and that the long shot will change the paradigm.
Audience, you're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about scientific consensus and how the average person can form an educated opinion on controversial topics. Email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be right back after this message.
Hi.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we talk to Jennifer Ouellette, author of The Calculus Diaries, How Math Can Help You Lose Weight, Win in Vegas, and Survive a Zombie Apocalypse. We'll find out how much advanced math figures into our daily lives, and how even the mathematically challenged can learn to love the language of numbers. And on Speaking Up, hip-hop science advocate Baba Brinkman returns to discuss his new project, The Rap Guide to Human Nature. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm on the line with Steve Toms, professional music teacher, amateur astronomer, and award-winning astrophotographer in Kitchener, Ontario. We're also joined by Eric Davis, technology professional based in Ontario, who holds an MBA in business strategy and a BA in English. And they're both contributors to SkepticNorth.com, the fabulous pan-Canadian skeptical blog collective. And we have a question from the chat room.
As skeptics, what exactly should we be looking for to recognize a source as credible and representing the consensus? And that's from David Gluck.
What should we be looking for? I don't know that, for my part, that I could give you any kind of hints as to what you should be looking for as credible, but there are some things that are not credible. You'll often see activist groups that are headed by people with no education or training in a given field whatsoever. And you'll see a very small number of people. Recently here in Kitchener-Waterloo, we had a thing about water fluoridation, and it's come up four times over the last 30 years. And one of the things that was brought up was that there was 3,100 professionals, including over 280 dentists, petitioned Congress to remove fluoride from the water. This was a few years ago. And that sounds impressive. You think, wow, 280 dentists. But when you compare that to the actual number of dentists in the U.S., which is 150,000, so that's less than 0.5%. You'll often see numbers just kind of thrown out there. But take those numbers and just compare them to the bigger number of the whole. And a similar thing was with naturopaths last year. They used to say that if we could give naturopaths the right to prescribe medication in Ontario, that will ease the burden on healthcare. Now, there are 800 naturopaths in Ontario and over 10,000 doctors. Just simple law of numbers is often such a huge red flag that I always kind of notice whenever I see them.
I always start with the sort of big sources. I mean, if I'm trying to explore an issue, I want to know if it's a health issue, I want to know what the WHO, what the FDA, what Health Canada says about it. I want to know what the Cancer Society, if that's relevant, or any of the societies that that manage research agendas think about it. If you just go to their websites, you'll usually find it pretty quickly. There's an awful lot of extraordinary information to aid someone who is looking at it. Start there as a base and look at the language they're using. Right in that quote that I read out from the WHO, it says the WHO has concluded the current evidence does not confirm the existence of any health consequences. That is a definitive statement. If you see an awful lot of, if you don't see those definitive statements, it may be that there is no consensus, or it may be that they are reserving judgment on a new treatment. I think we're seeing this with liberation therapy, the Dr. Zamboni's treatment for MS right now. Where there has been a scientific working model, but I don't think there's full scientific consensus around MS and how it all works right now. At least in the little I understand, I'm not going to claim to be an MS expert. But the new treatment flies in the face of the current working model, which is that it's an autoimmune disease. The research that we've seen, if you go to the MS Society in Canada, the U.S., has been tentative but promising, right? Which is, this is interesting. It's not what we expected, but we're going to spend some money funding it and do further research. That's not consensus, right? That is, that is working science that is still trying to come to a consensus on how it all works.
And we have an email question.
Public policy and law work on a different, much shorter timescale than science does. Since legal and political controversies often involve areas where scientific knowledge is not well established, does it actually make sense to rely on a scientific consensus that may well be tenuous and overturned in the near future? And that's from Jim Lippard.
Yeah, I think in that case, you're not talking about a scientific consensus. You're talking about working science, but I'll let Steve finish that.
Well, and too, I think that there is probably not a single science-minded individual out there that says that politics and policy should rely on scientific consensus or a scientific model. I think conventional wisdom tells us that science can, at best, inform public policy, but never dictate it. So I kind of don't think that anybody relies on science when it comes to public policy.
Well, public policy, I think, is trying to answer a different set of questions than science is, right? I mean, to the extent that the policy relies on a knowledge of what's happening and there is consensus, policy definitely should, you know, take that consensus as if it's the truth. I think in the case, and the MS is a good example. In fact, we're seeing this right now, right? So Saskatchewan has decided to fund a $5 million trial. They're actually putting in twice as much money as the MS Society in Canada and the U.S. combined are putting in to fund it. That's a policy decision. Is it a wise one? I don't really know, but in this case, there's no consensus that they're basing it on, right? They're basing it on probably largely political factors, right? We have MS is a horrible disease for an awful lot of people, and you know, the provinces are charged with delivering health care. But I think if we pull it up a level, a more generalized answer to that question is politicians have to look at risk-benefit analysis, right? In the absence of a consensus, you've got to weight the risks and the benefits of action versus inaction, try to come up with the best example. But I think in those cases, it's really important to build in sunset clauses, gates for reviews, to frame them as pilot programs. Because once things get funded and there's public policy around them, it's very hard to dislodge them just because the science goes and changes. So when there's not consensus and you want to, you know, and you decide that the risk-benefit analysis favors action versus inaction, then making sure that this is a provisional program is really important from a policy perspective.
And we have another website question.
Canada has recently declared BPA a toxic substance. Despite evaluations by Health Canada, the World Health Organization, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and the European Food Safety Authority, which have all found that the best studies, i.e. those using good laboratory practice standards, have shown no evidence of harm. Is this a case of public policy going against the scientific consensus?
I think that kind of underscores what Eric was just talking about, as far as it's a cost-benefit analysis. I think a mistake that a lot of people, including our policymakers and lawmakers, get into is when you get into a cost-benefit analysis and a risk of inaction, they will take that course first before accepting the science and the scientific consensus. And I think that might be one of the cases here. I'm obviously not an expert on the chemical, I'm kind of uncertain that the Canadian government acted right on this one.
And we have another website question.
I've done my research, and I side with the experts on climate change. Now, how do I convince my Republican uncle that anthropogenic global warming is consensus science, not a socialist plot? Christmas dinner is coming. Please help. And that's from Darren.
If I knew the answer to that, I would have many happy Thanksgiving dinners.
I think, you know, the way I've tried it, and we come up against this issue all the time with our friends and family. It's easy when you're writing a blog to just put it out there and be the expert and do the research and hope people listen. When you're, when you're actually dealing with family members, it's obviously a lot more tenuous. What I've found that works, and I think the only thing I've found that works, is not to admit I know the answer. When someone raises some of these things, I tend to just say, it's interesting. I've looked at this a little, and there were some sources I've seen online that seem to differ. You know, would you mind if I send you stuff? I can send it to you when I get home. And then I usually look for the most concise, clear, and credible source of information. I did this recently with an extended family member who, was not sold on evolution. And I know that sounds crazy to anybody who's but there are people out there, and there was one in my extended family. He's a scientist, he's an engineer. He gave the example of the human eye and how it's irreducible complexity, which is a fairly standard evolutionary argument. And I just kind of said, well, you know, I'm not sure I agree with that. I'm no expert on the human eye, and you know, I'm not a biologist, but I've seen some stuff online, and you know, I can send it to you if you want. And of course, most people will say yeah, because people don't want to admit they don't want to get new information. And then I found the PBS Evolution series, a nice, you know, neutral source of information with a very succinct article on why that's bunk. And I flipped it off to him, and the next time I saw him, he said, I want to talk about evolution. You're swaying me. And you know, it's one of the few big successes I think I've had, but it's because I did not, you know, I took the role of what I think is a good teacher, which is to beg the question and let people teach themselves.
I think it's always important to remember that a lot of people identify with their beliefs, and the more strongly they believe in a thing, the more likely they are to have that thing form part of their identity. And when you mentioned the socialist plot, I don't know, I think he might be a little bit too entrenched in that one, but a gentle approach that doesn't offend them personally. Just ask very general, polite, open-ended questions that question their expertise. I had a person ask me what I thought about global warming, and I said, I have no expertise whatsoever as a climate scientist or as any kind of scientist, but I do know what most scientists who are experts say. And I don't have any personal reason to doubt what they say. And that's kind of generally how I take it, these sorts of things. When it comes to family, that's a whole other can of worms, though. I don't know that I could stab that one.
Eric, Steve, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
You can find both Eric Davis and Steve Toms at skepticnorth.com. And you can find us at skepticallyspeaking.com. Click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes and subscribe to the show. And while you're there, do consider leaving a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
This is Sharon Hill of The Doubtful Blog and the Keystone Society for Rational Inquiry. Science in our society is generally held in high regard as a way to obtain reliable knowledge about the world. Surveys consistently show that scientists are trusted and respected members of our society. Because of this, images and words that sound sciency are used and abused by advertisers and special interest groups to lend credibility to their presentation. You'll notice this appeal to science in advertisements for beauty products or diet supplements, or used to legitimize religious-based ideas like intelligent design, or even to hunt ghosts. An audience can find something more believable or worthwhile if it's promoted with words and images associated with science. Why does this work? While scientific words are impressive to the untrained ear, they sound complicated and technical. Energy and quantum are probably the two most common sciencey-sounding words misused to invoke a feeling of intelligence and sophistication. The average non-scientist doesn't understand precise scientific words, but that's not surprising, considering scientists require special training for their work. It's no different than other specialized professions like mechanics, dentists, and electricians, for example. Just as you might be confused by an unscrupulous mechanic describing why you need your car fixed, you might be fooled by someone throwing sciencey-sounding explanations around. The public admires science, but typically won't make the extra effort to understand it. That makes them vulnerable to giving sciencey-sounding ideas more credit than they deserve. It pays to be aware that someone might be using a science-like appearance as a way to impress you, but may actually have a whole lot of nothing underneath. You can read about imitating science by visiting my blog at idoubtit.wordpress.com and click on Sham Inquiry.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Ray Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is recorded live at CJSR in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Michael Harrison manages our electronic communications. The soundboard is run by Ryan Bromsgrove. Lisa Skovanek is our assistant studio technician. Post-production editing and additional research by K.O. Myers. Our theme song is written and recorded by AOK, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell.